This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 179, For the Love of Spock. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Larry Nemechek. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Paramount's invitation to a fan to pitch a TV series, and Nichelle Nichols' recovery. Plus, Mike Rittenhouse and Noah Butler of Five-Year Mission drop by to preview their Spock's Brain EP. Then in the feature, we're joined by Adam Nimoy to discuss his documentary, Trek, and his dad. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Larry. It's great to have you back here with me on the Ready Room once again. And once again, it's Leonard Nimoy who's bringing us together. But today, we're not remembering so much that he passed away, but we're talking to his son, Adam, in the future about the documentary that's coming up.
Right, right. Not so much that he's left us, but that the fact that he will always be with us.
Exactly. And also, I was able to snag you before you're jetting out of town because you're always on the go, it seems.
Yes, we're about to have another trip, speaking of documentaries, to shoot a few more people for the Con of Wrath in Texas and Oklahoma. And I'm going to be back home at my homie's home turf with SoonerCon, talking about all things Trekland and Star Trek Continues and Enterprise in Space and all that good stuff.
I don't think we have a con back if I went back home. It'd be like Capstone Con or something there in Tuscaloosa, but I think it's only about football down there.
Now, Chris, if there's one thing, I had to endure this in the 80s where the sci-fi and the football communities were mutually exclusive back then, but we've come oh so far since then. And I have to think there's I was in Huntsville. And I know this NASA and the space community there. I've given a Star Trek, not a convention appearance, but I did a real Stars Trek Stars presentation for a Huntsville audience. So I know there's fans there in Alabama.
There are fans. Now, I didn't know you back then, but did you go to the 30th anniversary bash in Huntsville back in 1996?
Well, Chris, if I reminded you that, oh, whoa, one weekend on Earth, the 30th anniversary con for Star Trek in 96, was the first time that StarTrek.com had just been launched, and it was its first public appearance, and things were being live streamed, and that was when the team was first together. But I was there representing .com and in the 90s. But yes, I was there. And
I was there too. I've got my badge right over here hanging by this shelf full of DVDs, so...
I can't believe you didn't come over and say hi. What a snot you were. It's a good thing you went abroad and got a little appreciation and perspective on things.
You know, I knew you were an Oklahoma fan, so...
Okay. Like I was going to wear my Sooners on my sleeve running around Alabama. No, I just remember everybody talking about how they had to take 9 planes to get to Huntsville from L.A. That was kind of...
Yeah, it's not easy to get to. All right. Well, let's get into some Star Trek news here. We've got 3 things we're going to talk about before we bring Adam in during the feature. The first one is this news story that's kind of blown up, I guess, a little bit this week. You asked me yesterday if this was a controversy, and at the time I said no, but then I saw today that Kayla, who wrote this piece for TrekMovie.com, was a little bit upset that someone had called her out about it. I didn't really think anything unusual about what she wrote. This is the story about Michael Gummelt, and I may be mispronouncing your name there, Michael. If I am, I apologize, who owned the domain StarTrekBeyond.com and had been working on a series idea for the last 20 years called Star Trek Beyond, who has now been invited by Paramount to come in and pitch the series. Now, what do you think about this, Larry?
Well, what's interesting, and I've had kind of a blurry month this month, more than I thought, but about a month ago, Michael had actually written to me just basically on the side saying, I've had this opportunity to pitch to Paramount, which at the time struck me a little odd. But he was reaching out, wondering if I knew of anyone who had industry experience who wanted to co-pitch with him, basically, but kind of sharing that information. And there was a piece of me that thought, well, this is interesting. I mean, some of the things that people have been skeptical about. But it was very intelligently written. And then I didn't get back to it. And then when the story came, when Kayla did her story, I went, wait a minute, that guy wrote to me a month ago, just on the side. And I basically got back to him and I said, oh, well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to not, ignore you, but it was a crazy month, but it looks like this is, kind of ballooned up. And he said, yes, but I don't know, when just on the side, when I got into it, one of the people that his own project was originally called Star Trek Beyond.
Yeah.
And he's since changed the name Star Trek Uncharted and talk about, well, maybe there was some kind of a arrangement to clear the name of Star Trek Beyond, since that's the Justin Lin, that's the Star Trek Roman numeral, Arabic numeral 3, the new JJ, Bad Robot movie title.
Yeah. Well, that was my first thought when I read the story as well, is that I'm sure the studio wants the domain, and I have no doubt that they're inviting him in to pitch, but it's Paramount, and CBS is the studio that would control the rights to Star Trek on television, so it seemed odd to me that the movie studio would be inviting someone in to pitch for a TV series. And so my first impression was, well, they're probably bringing him in to pitch, and they're going to get the domain, they're going to get the name cleared out, and it's going to be amicable. They're not going to have lawyers involved and all that kind of stuff. But do you think there's more to it than that?
I don't know. That could be the root of it. And maybe in passing, it's one of these things where if someone is trying to be inclusive, they think, well, what can be the harm in hearing some of his ideas? Mm-hmm. He does have credit from the game industry and writing for, was it Elite Force?
Elite Force, which is, for a lot of fans, is one of their very favorite Star Trek video games that was made.
Yeah, it's the original Elite Force, right.
Yeah, the first one, yeah.
So, it's part of me thinks it's just kind of the high road for dealing with a situation like that on the studio side. It's like, well, why not have him come in and listen to that? And who knows what kind of pawnsmanship is going on here back then. Things are always spinning and churning and people exploring, pushing the envelopes and boundaries and things. We live in a very fluxy time, I always like to say here. But the backlash against this has been, I've got no doubt as to his veracity. It's just, it's more like not what he's up to. It's more like what's, going to happen with Paramount, and who knows,
right.
But he's going to take advantage of it. Who wouldn't? It's just kind of, I guess it's predictable. Some of the backlash that I've seen in some quarters and people saying, well, we've had much higher profile people want to pitch series. And it's, that's not what's in play here. Who knows? Stranger things have happened, and who knows?
Well, the premise of the series, for those who are wondering, is, I looked over the website, and to be honest, I'm not very excited about the actual idea itself, but the general premise, I think that he's in line with what I and a lot of people think about Star Trek, which is that it needs to evolve. He told Kayla that this concept has gone through a lot of different incarnations over the past 20 years since I first started working on it. But the way I look at it now is it should first and foremost be a show that can stand on its own. It shouldn't rely too heavily on any deep, intimate knowledge of every past Trek show and movie. It would be very tempting to put in all sorts of references and trivia that only fans like me would get. But for Trek to return to TV after so long, it needs to be reinvented for a new generation. not a reboot. That's already been done in the movies. But this would be a Star Trek series that feels modern and feels futuristic relative to our current times. So, you know, I mean, I agree with him on all that. I think that it does have to evolve, and you're not going to hook in a new audience if it's all filled with inside baseball references.
Well, right. I mean, some of this, there's that old phrase about every war starts off by people fighting the last war, mm-hmm. you know, until they readjust to where the world is. But I think people expect that of any new movie or series. People expect that of a movie franchise, I should say, or series. They expect that on Star Trek, when you can't help but, I mean, I don't think anybody sat around in 86 and 87, and the people that didn't like this, the new news about the Next Generation, it was about the format. But no one sat around and thought, you know, either, gee, I hope they shoot it just like they did 20 years ago in the 60s, or, you know, gee, I hope they don't shoot it like they did 20 years ago in the 60s. You know, the pajama colors and all that. No one sat around and worried about that. Where people, when they talk about Star Trek's return in whatever medium, always worry about, you know, will it be, it needs to stand on its own and be modern and be, well, of course it's made by people today. No, unless it's a historical, you know, the Star Trek Continues approach is to be a historical recreation, and that's what its goal is.
Right.
But anyone doing a new commercial venture is going to be a product of its own time, and on the tech side, on the TV production tech, as well as the culture that it's made in.
Right.
So I think sometimes that's a false. But I think it's true they can't wallow in it, but I think it should still be respectful.
Well,
I think it's doomed too.
Maybe where he's coming from here is that I think in terms of creative professionals working on it and the studio, as you say, that's the route they're going to go. It's going to be modern. It's going to be updated. But if you read a lot of discussions online, which of course I know you do, of Star Trek fans, there's a large percentage of the fan base that basically they want Voyager back, or they want TNG back. You know, they want the Star Trek that they're very familiar with and all the wrappings of that back as well. And if you were to do that, now, like you said, Continues, that's their goal, is to make a historically accurate recreation and continuation of the original series, which they do beautifully. But if you did that with a new series, with all new cast and new characters and everything, I don't know that that would have that hook on TV. And so there maybe is sort of a split in vision between a lot of fandom and what the creatives would actually do.
Well, that's a product of the fact that we're in a sea of inertia right now. There's no forward momentum, and there's no single creative force. I mean, when the Next Generation was at its height, Berman and the team were like, okay, what's the next thing going to be? Well, no, they're not going to copy Next Generation for the next show that the studio was demanding that they do. Like, if you guys don't give us more, we'll go somewhere else. So they did it. You know, it was like, okay, this was a ship. Let's go to a station. And, you know, we've gone through all the recordings. And then Voyager is, well, what's different from that? Well, let's take us away from our familiar underpinnings and go out here. So everything, when there's a leadership and a forward momentum going that's empowered to make decisions, creative decisions like that, big picture ones, that's happening. When you're sitting in the middle of a desert with nobody in charge and no clear vision and no one, you know, just making those decisions, then it is kind of a free-for-all. It is kind of a mob rule or a mob vote. And people are saying this. And a lot of people, in light of having a creative vision to go forward, do fall back on what's familiar because it's what they enjoy. And part of that you can't blame them. But some people, I think, in the middle of all that chaos, do say, hey, guys, we do have to go to something else. And then when you get in that realm, then you have five different versions of what to do when you go to that side of things. So, you know, do you go further into the future? Do you go back, you know, April's time, midway between original series and next gen somewhere? You know, Klingon show, whatever, you know.
Let me ask you this. If someone made a series, now this particular idea is set, as I understand it, kind of far off in the future, like far enough away from the 24th century that it doesn't matter, you know, the connection. It's easier to get away from the connection.
Right.
But I heard another thing recently where it's set between TOS and Generations, I guess, like the beginning of Generations when you have the 1701B being christened. Do you think it's possible to do a show set between Kirk's time and the Next Generation era, or
or even, you know, like the 1701B, and make that modern and make that new and still connect it with the mythos that we love and make it feel like Star Trek? Or in that time period, are you going to be locked in because you have to bridge those time periods?
You mean, are you going to be in the Enterprise dilemma, supposedly, of making a show set in a...
Well,
having a modern-produced show set in a time before the show of the 60s was shot. So how do you resolve the...
Well, sort of, but not the just visual? The visual aesthetic. But Enterprise is actually a bit easier, I think, because they were before. But here you would have a show that's set in the middle. So you would already have the five-year mission, everything, and then you would have to go after that.
It's totally possible. It is totally possible. It's who has who's running things, who's handing over the keys to whom, and do they have a clue? I hope if they're thinking about the franchise as a whole, I mean, I've said this before. We love the characters, we love the stories, we love the morality plays, we love the cool tech. But the thing that gets ignored and even made fun of, and sometimes I join in too, but the greater continuity, you know. Be a canonista if you want to call it that, but at least the general flow is what's made Star Trek unlike any other, with exception maybe of, you know, Star Wars and Doctor Who both have their own continuity so far, and find ways to deal with that. But I think the granddaddy of them all is got to be Star Trek, and I know a lot of creatives and old showrunners and potential new ones see that as a challenge, but I think maybe the fact that our society and our creative community has been so soaked with fans, what we started to seeing eventually over the run of even the old shows, Voyager and Enterprise, was we had a lot of fanboys and fangirls having the reins, and it wasn't so difficult to do that. And I'm hoping by the time we get around to having a series, that won't be seen as that, you know, oh, it's a rock around my neck to have to deal with 700 hours of canon. Go do it. Do a show. And like he's saying here, you don't have to wallow in canon references every 5 seconds, but just have something that's respectful and then find your footing. And once what Next Generation did, you know, we talk about how famously Next Generation avoided all the original series references as much as they could. But at some point, they got comfortable with having Sarek in. They got comfortable with having Scotty on. They finally had, you know.
And then Deep Space Nine wallows in original series references. They're all over the place in DS9.
That's not just so much that series. It's the arc of the TV era, the Gene de Berman era. So the DS9 is really 5, 6, 7 years into that comfort zone.
Yeah.
You know, they that team had gotten there already with Next Gen.
Yeah.
So it's very doable. It's totally up to who's got the insight and awareness to do that. And it'll be prime-ish. Who knows?
Okay.
But I think the closer it would be, it'll make it stronger. And
yeah,
you know, we'll cross that bridge when we get there, and it'll be interesting because when those decisions finally do get made about who's doing what and how and what they're allowed to do and how much free reign, and if that's the person we want to have the free reign or not, or if they're smart enough to get someone under them who's really, you know, supplying that while they provide the nameplate or whatever it is. Yeah, we'll know then. But it is possible. It's not an impossible task.
All right. Well, to close out this story, just last thought here. I personally don't think Star Trek Uncharted is going to be the next series. I still really think that it's a wonderful opportunity, and congratulations to Michael, but I still feel like the studio, in this case, is bringing him in, listening to him, and they're getting the domain they want, and they're getting the name cleared that they want for the next movie. But do you think that the fact that they are having him come in and they're listening, is this moving us any closer to getting a new series? Does it show that there's real interest there in the mess that is the whole Paramount CBS, all the stuff that goes on there?
Oh God, who knows? But it is interesting the fact that he indicated, I think even publicly said, I have been cleared to say that I'm doing this. So, which he wouldn't say if it wasn't. So, the fact that this is almost like Cold War doublespeak here. It's like, what does this mean? What does that mean? Or, you know, any kind of international intrigue. It's like, okay, the fact that they're allowing him to say he's pitching a series at, you know, what does that mean? Is that some kind of, you know, Hollywood gamesmanship here about what's going on? Or is it just free publicity for them? If somebody really savvy And this is, hey, let's spin this way, and why not? What's the harm? Let's do that. And that's exactly what's happening.
That's what I feel is going on personally.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Who knows at this point?
All right. Well, Larry, I had a chance earlier before you came on, because the wonderful things we call time zones, which make a recording and coordinating very difficult, I sat down with Mike Rittenhouse and Noah Butler of 5-Year Mission because their EP of Spock's Brain is getting ready to drop on July 3rd. And we recorded a quick segment about that. So we're going to hop into that real quick, and then we'll be back in a moment with you to talk a little bit more, Larry. So I'm here today with Mike and Noah from 5-Year Mission. Guys, welcome back to the Ready Room.
Thanks for having us.
It's been a long time since you were on here. In the past, we've had you on before your big albums drop, so you've got lots and lots of tracks, you've done acoustic sets. This time, though, you have a very special album, another EP, based on Spock's Brain.
Yes.
My first question for both of you guys is, how many times in a row did you watch Spock's Brain in order to write your pieces? And what was that like?
I think for all of us, it was different. I watched it maybe only 2 or 3 times.
That's all you could take?
I didn't subject myself to it too much. Yeah.
Once for me. Just once.
Okay, so Noah, 1 time, Mike, 2 or 3 times. Oh, I was hoping you were going to say 10 or 12 or 15, because I've come to feel over the years that Spock's Brain is a masterpiece. Like, it's so bad that it's brilliantly bad.
I actually like the episode. I don't think that it's that bad of an episode. I can easily come up with several others that I like less than Spock's Brain.
Yeah. I don't think it's the worst episode by far. I don't think it's the worst, but it's definitely, it has its so bad it's almost good moments, you know, at least in my opinion.
Yeah.
Well, tell everyone about the concept of this album. You did one a couple of years ago for The Trouble with Tribbles. So similar concept for Spock's Brain, although I believe this time there may be a little twist.
Well, on the Tribbles EP, we each wrote 1 song, and even Andy wrote a song. So all 5 of us got to sing 1 song on that EP. And we started to do the same thing for Spock's Brain, and somehow it turned into
it was Chris's fault. He submitted.
All right. I should probably tell the whole thing because okay.
Go ahead.
So we draw the names of the episodes for each album, and we had already talked about doing this Spock's Brain EP, and we had decided that whoever drew Spock's Brain for year 4 gets to write a second Spock's Brain song.
Okay.
And this was Chris's idea. Well, Chris is the one who draws Spock's Brain when we're doing this. And immediately he's like, ah, no, I don't want Spock's Brain. I don't want to have to write 2 songs. And so after we did a little swapping around, I ended up with Spock's Brain because I was like, fine, I don't hate the episode. I will write 2 songs. And so we all start submitting our songs for the EP. And Chris, he submits his first song. And then, like, a couple weeks later, he sends a second song. And
okay.
Yeah, and we're all like, why did you send a second song?
The guy who didn't want to write even one in the first place.
Right.
I guess inspiration struck and he couldn't help himself.
Yeah, he said that he had another idea and he really liked it, so he went ahead and wrote it. So at that point, he has two Spock's Brain songs and the rest of us only have one.
But he was under the mindset that he was going to choose only one of those two.
Yeah.
But both of them were fantastic. Yeah. Both of them were really, really good.
And totally different from each other. And so we decided to keep both. And then the rest of us also wrote a second Spock's Brain song. So now there's 10 Spock's Brain songs instead of just 5.
So it's not really an EP. It's a Spock's Brain album.
Yeah, it's an album
with
now.
10 songs and a secret track.
Yeah.
This is an EEP, an extended play album.
Right. And what's even better is that I still have Spock's Brain for year 4. So now I will be writing a third Spock's Brain song.
To go on year 4.
Yeah, so there will be even another one after this album.
So in the end, fans are going to be treated to 11 different takes on Spock's Brain.
Yes.
Yes.
That's incredible. Absolutely incredible.
And actually, they're pretty much all very different from each other.
Yeah, they are.
You would think that we would run out of ideas and episode plots or whatever, but there's a lot of different stuff on there, so it doesn't really get old or repetitive. Except for several songs where we yell Spock's Brain repeatedly. But other than that.
Is there a song about the magic hand that can extract people's brains by mere touch?
We make reference to that scene, but I don't think anyone actually mentions that specific.
Or calls it a magic hand.
There you go. 12th track.
There's your idea for your next song.
Mike. Yeah, yeah. I better put that in the Spock's Brain that's going on year 4.
She's got the Midas touch.
I do mention magic belts in one of my songs.
Yes,
though.
You do say magic belt.
Okay, well, you have to do that. So what was the experience like of putting the album together? Were there any really memorable moments, anything crazy that happened when you were recording or writing?
I think it certainly was really fun to have people, you know, have to write 2 songs when we challenged ourselves to do 2 songs, to really come up with 2 songs that were not only different from each other, but then different from the other 10 songs that we're going to be out there. So it was a lot of fun to hear the demos come in and hear what people were doing. That was just a lot of fun, especially Andy's, because, you know, he had to do 2 of them. And actually one of them we didn't keep. He wound up writing a different one. So he technically did 3 songs. So that was fun. The writing process was definitely fun. And I think the recording process this time, usually we've always had a home base for recording where we just kind of do everything there. But that isn't how it worked this time. We kind of had to do a lot of recording in different places on the, you know, kind of portable on the go, which was different. But I thought it went fairly smoothly.
Yeah. The majority was recorded in Patrick's basement.
But a lot was at Hero House.
Yeah. And even some stuff here at your house.
Yeah. And some stuff here. Yeah.
What about inspirations? I know you guys draw upon a lot of different musical influences, which is one thing that makes your albums really interesting. So this time, Noah, for Spock's Brain, what was your influence for the track that you finally put together?
Well, for the first track, the track that opens the album called Hey Kara, I wanted to capture, you know, the badness of the episode, the cheesiness, the triteness of the episode. So I really went for kind of an 80s, you know,
kind of a Rick Springfield.
A very, you know, pop, power pop, you know, sort of thing with some really trite lyrics and I kind of, you know, just did a whole different, it's almost like a love song between, you know, one of the morgues and Kara. Now, if in a fantasy situation where they somehow, you know, had a relationship. And then,
I don't know if that's a fantasy situation, Noah. I'm sure there's some fanfic out there somewhere where that happens.
There may be. Here, maybe. Well, so it is. It's sort of a bit of fan fiction. And then for the other song, Colder in Russia, the inspiration for that is poor. I think Mike mentioned it early on that poor Chekhov is in it for 5 minutes at the beginning, just standing in the cold while they all go down below the surface. You know, and 45 minutes later, you know, that
he's still standing there.
He's been standing in the cold for God knows how long.
He zapped some rocks,
hanging out with some red shirts at the cave entrance. And it's like, well, there's a whole story there. Poor Chekhov standing in the cold. So that was, and no one else was writing about Chekhov standing in the cold. So,
okay. Yeah. It's not the most obvious of choices, but when you have to write 11 tracks
exactly
about one episode, then that makes sense. What about you, Mike?
Let's see. My first song on the album is called An Awful Lot of Trouble. And it just kind of explains what's happening in the episode and kind of pointing out the ridiculousness of it. It's not really like hardly any of the stuff that I've written before. It's a little more
both musically, vocally.
Yeah, it's a little more like kind of on the screamy metal side.
Okay.
Kind of, yeah. Very shouty.
Yeah, shouty. Not screamy, shouty. There's a difference.
Well, Arena was a little bit shouty as well.
Yeah,
part.
A little bit. But the Arena, the verses were sang, but the choruses were shouted. This is pretty much just everything is shouted.
Okay.
Not to compete with Andy's second song,
which is a screaming
which is screaming.
Screaming for 42 seconds.
Yeah, it's a treat. It'll be a treat.
Is the song 42 seconds
the
long?
Song is 42 seconds long.
It's awesome though. It's so good. But yeah, my first song, it was just for fun. The music I actually wrote when I was like 15. It was just some metal song.
Oh, really?
I wrote when I was 15, and I decided to use it and write new words. And it turned out pretty good.
Yeah.
My other song is, I mean, it's about Spock's brain, but it's more about an overall theme in Star Trek.
Centered around Jim Kirk.
Which is, Kirk shows up, destroys your god, and leaves you to figure things out.
Right, right. Now, do you also have the song about the cleanup ship that follows the Enterprise and then beams down to the planet to fix all the problems after Kirk leaves, and then they trail him to the next planet?
That would be actually a pretty good series.
It would be, just following the cleanup ship.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that was the origin of the Oberth class ship, because that little ship looks like something that would be designed to trail the Enterprise.
Someone should make like a web series or something. This is like little 5-minute episodes of a cleanup definitely. Crew that follows the NCC 1701 around. And just do like every episode. That'd be pretty good.
That would actually be pretty funny.
That would be great. So, quick question before we talk about when the album's going to be available. Have you thought about a future EP? Is there another episode that has grabbed you so tightly that you feel you need to write at least 11 tracks about it?
Should we tell him our whole idea or just a brief,
we can give a little bit of a hint of what we're doing. The other one that we have in mind for doing possibly between year 4 and year 5 is actually just completely based on an inside joke.
Yeah, I'll attempt to explain. It's not complicated, but every time we kind of screw around with a song or come up with an idea or a lick or something like that, and we're all just standing around, maybe waiting for another guy to show up at practice or something, our default, we have like 2 default lyrics that we start singing to whatever it is, and it's always Lights of Zetar or Cloudminders. Somehow we sing those 2 titles to whatever random thing it is we're singing, and it's hilarious to us.
Yeah.
I don't know that it isn't anybody else, but it's very funny to us. So we were thinking of doing sort of a Lights of Zetar, Cloudminders, split EP, however that works out. We've got some ideas.
But. Yeah.
Well, if it's anything like Spock's brain, I think it's going to be a two-disc set.
It might be. Or it might be.
I think that would be okay.
It'll be at least 10 songs.
Yeah. I think it'll be at least 10 songs, yeah.
Probably 5 about each episode.
Yeah.
You guys really do bring new meaning to the term EP. All right. So when will Spock's brain be available to everyone?
Well, our Kickstarter backers who pledged at the $100 level, they got a early...
Yeah, they already have it.
They already have it. They got an early download, which they were very happy about. But then the actual release is...
July 3rd. We should have the CDs back within a week before July 3rd, and we will start filling people's orders then. So anyone who's ordered that should be getting it during that week. As far as the digital release, I would like for it to come out close to July 3rd, but usually it takes a little while for
iTunes stuff.
Yeah, for the Spotify and iTunes and all those sites to process it. So hopefully it'll be out shortly after July 3rd.
Excellent. And if people want to pre-order, where should they go for your website and also any social media links?
They can order from our website, which is 5yearmission.net, and you can spell that with the number 5 or with the word 5. Either way, it'll take you to our website. And to keep in touch with us and follow everything we're doing, we're on Facebook, 5yearmission, and we're also on Twitter, and that's the number 5yearmission on Twitter.
Well, I know everyone is really excited to get their hands on the EP and get their hands on Spock's brain when it comes out, and I'm looking forward to hearing the whole album myself. So thanks for sitting down with me tonight and letting everyone know about Spock's brain.
No problem.
No problem.
So Larry, these guys wrote 11 different songs about Spock's brain. And as I told them, I have come to feel that Spock's brain is brilliantly bad. How do you feel about Spock's brain?
Songs and songs. What are songs?
If they don't say that somewhere on this EP, I'm going to be very disappointed. Do you also think that Spock's brain is brilliant in its badness?
You know, I'm trying to think back in the old days. If I watched Spock's brain in the daily rotation and just thought it was as horrendous as I'm supposed to think it was before I learned to know that it was the horrendous show. I remember thinking, you know, like, and the children shall lead was way crazier. I remember thinking, realizing that when the colors got prettier, yeah, and the uniforms got neater and the camera work seemed to be better, that's when the shows got a little looser. I didn't enjoy them as much back, you know, before you had the insight and awareness. Yeah. Brilliantly bad. I just, you know, just brain and brain, what is brain? That's just the line that I remember from the show, even before I knew I was supposed to know that line, and the miniskirts and all of that. And brilliantly bad.
I just think it's brilliant. You know, everyone says it's the worst episode, and I tell people, actually,
I disagree, but yes.
It's entertaining to watch, and so if it's something that is entertaining to watch, then it can't be classified as one of the worst episodes. So I quite enjoy it myself.
Well, it's the one where you get to hear McCoy say, "My God, Jim, I think I can cure a rainy day," or whatever I think that is.
Right.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, he's worse than dead. His brain is gone.
He'll die. He'll die. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go on to the last thing we're going to talk about before we bring Adam in. And this is something that I haven't had an opportunity to discuss on the shows. And this is the fact that Nichelle Nichols on June 3rd was hospitalized following a stroke. And I understand that she's recovering well right now. On June 15th, she did an interview with Entertainment Tonight.
Yes.
And she said, "I am feeling the best that I felt in a very long time. I have this thing about so-called sickness. I can't say it about everything, but I've always felt since I was a little girl that if you deny it, it will go away. And it does." And so that's a good thought. I try that myself, actually, in my own life. But you talked to Nichelle not too long before she had the stroke, right?
Yeah. And can I just say that after the year we have had, losing Leonard, losing Harve Bennett, when I first saw the first kind of breaking news about her stroke, I was like, Jesus.
I know, right? Yeah, I had the same reaction. Yeah.
Come on, Kalis or the Prophets or whatever's going on. Could somebody just give us a break this year? Can we just get into next year without losing anymore? So it was really, I almost think that's part of the story here, is that it's been so heartwarming. It's been, I mean, she's in her 80s and she will not be with us for forever. But she was very, she was pretty spry when we talked to her in March. We finally got her rounded up to talk for the Con of Wrath. And we talked a little bit of field also. She also said a couple of words. She's endorsed Enterprise in Space, and she said a few words on camera to go with what she had said in text in support, which we really appreciate. And just talking about some of the things up in her studio, but in her memento corner. So we had just talked to her in March. And so to just get this breaking news, it just hit me that it's like, oh, no, not... Not another one, but I really think it's been wonderful that her team, her agent, got word out very soon, very quickly, that it was a quote-unquote minor stroke, that, you know, they very quickly had little reports out on her sites that she had friends, that she was talking, eating, feeling good, you know, kind of poo-pooing the whole thing. They'd ran scans. They put out word about her CAT scan and the other scan they did. And that here's what's going on. That was an interesting bit. And again, it kind of shows where the world of we're not waiting on a publicist to put out word that Variety will have the next day, and then maybe into the 80s and 90s that Entertainment Tonight will show that night because it's the one that's tied into Paramount. You know, that we're having these things instantaneously, and it's knocking down rumor, and it's getting good news out as fast as it's getting scary news. So that was, again, almost like a dual level to the whole thing, a nature. But it was wonderful to see that. And the fact that E.T. did have her on quickly kind of shows, and maybe that's even in light of losing Leonard earlier, that they pounced on the story and got it out into a mainstream TV news, not even a website somewhere, but one of the TV produced shows. That's the 15th. Yeah. She had the stroke on the 3rd. So they had her on proclaiming that on camera to a mass audience, which was wonderful. I mean, wonderful for her, obviously. But again, it says something about Star Trek and the iconic original actors and how beloved they are, and where the decision makers of media are realizing people want to hear from them and hear about this.
Absolutely. And it's so wonderful that she's recovering well, because I had the same reaction you did when I saw the headline. I was like, again, and now it's Nichelle. And I've had experience with family members who have had strokes, and, you know, I know how they recovered or didn't recover. And so I was kind of nervous, and we've lost so many people this year. But so she was doing fairly well when you saw her in March, and now she says she's feeling better than she has in a long time. So hopefully the outlook is good for her.
Hopefully that's good. I mean, I just noticed that she's doing cons all the time, and she's even going to Europe and going overseas to conventions. And a year ago, the FedCon, which is the big convention in Germany, the FedCon last year that I was lucky enough to be able to go as a guest, and she was there. On the Sunday, her regular Q&A hour, she missed, and there were a lot of rumors going around. They said, well, she's just was just tired, exhausted, and people are like, oh, no, she's collapsed. She made a big point about getting word out. That's not what happened. And then they, in Europe, they have big opening and big closing ceremonies. They're big, where they bring there's the headliner all the way down through 20 people to the behind-the-scenes people, whoever there, and they're all on stage one by one at the beginning, and they all come out one by one at the end. And she was kind of the top liner at that, and it was a very, I say a big show, I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but she made a point that same day, that Sunday afternoon, of coming out and saying, you know, it was kind of like the reports of my, you know, demise have been greatly exaggerated kind of a thing, came out, told stories, was the most focused I'd seen her in ages, danced with everybody on stage.
Oh, really?
Some of the staff, I mean, like, as they had the band, you know, it's kind of like this eternal goodbye thing where they have music come up and people are just partying and people are in the audience clapping and singing, and everybody on stage is goofing around, and people are just mixing it up with each other. Kind of like, it's like the end of Saturday Night Live, only it goes on for 10 or 15 minutes kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah.
And she was taking, you know, and I don't know if, I never did chase it down, but I did a couple of turns with her, I hope is on camera. But she made a very big point of saying, you know, hey, everybody gets a little tired. And, you know, it was kind of like, give me a break. I'm in my 80s, but don't worry. I'm not, you know, I'm here, baby. And you haven't heard the last of me yet. Kind of a, you know, cheerful defiance. So, which kind of comes through in this statement when she was on ET, kind of that same tone. So, you know, good on
her.
That's
great.
And yeah, let's see her around next year for the big 5-0.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Okay, well, let's go ahead and transition, and we'll bring in Adam and talk about his documentary and his dad.
I can't wait for this.
Perhaps no one better symbolizes Star Trek and the message behind it than Leonard Nimoy. Just as fathers influence their children, Leonard Nimoy did this for millions around the world. And today, as we record this on Father's Day, or at least it's Father's Day for me here in Japan and the eve there for you guys in the States, we're joined by someone who knows this better than anyone, Leonard's son, Adam, who is currently working on a documentary, For the Love of Spock, that will not only chronicle Leonard Nimoy's career, but also help us all remember the incredible talent and influence that he was. Adam, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
It's wonderful to have you here. Larry and I, we actually recorded a show together in February after your father passed away, remembering him. And So we're really happy to have you here today to talk more about that and your experience growing up with him. And we have a lot of different things we want to talk to you about, both of us do. But let's start off with the documentary itself and how that idea first came about.
The documentary was originally conceived by me, actually. I've been reading a number of books about the making of Star Trek, and it felt like there wasn't really that much in-depth discussion about the creation of Mr. Spock and the evolution of the character. And certainly very little about the impact of the character and how he has managed to survive for 50 years and become such a pop culture icon. And I approached my dad about the possibility of doing a documentary that was Spock-centric, just about really Mr. Spock, because he and I were both aware that we were coming up on the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, the original series, which is happening next year in 2016. And I wanted to do something with him to kind of celebrate that event. He immediately sparked the idea of doing the documentary. He was very interested in doing that right away. And in fact, immediately we started talking about what it would be about and how it would be organized and whether it would be narrated and whether, you know, how much involvement he would have in it. And when Dad passed away in February due to end-stage COPD, there was so much outpouring of emotion, not only about Mr. Spock, but about Leonard Nimoy, the artist, and the social activist and humanist, that it became clear to me that I had to expand the project to include the life of and legacy of Leonard Nimoy as well as Mr. Spock, and that the fans, there's so much emotional feedback and sympathy and grief, you know, kind of collectively from the Trek community and people who are not necessarily in that community, that it became really clear to me that I should continue on with producing and directing this film.
Well, that's, I wrote a piece for the official magazine and had, which grew out of my reaction. And obviously you're his son and you've, you've got the familial father-son relationship, nothing can top that. But in the middle of all that, in your private life and in your private family circle, when you were able to notice, were you taken aback? I mean, obviously, you just said he's an iconic character, an iconic actor. But even given all that, were you a little taken aback at the way the world reacted to his passing and mainstream media and all of that? Because that's what crystallized for me and what kind of made me realize where the world has come to and also the channels that social media give us, was it was the most, it was a very, it was the most public and shared mourning of anything in the Star Trek community to begin with. And then beyond that, I remember thinking, I wonder what the greater world, the greater media, how they'll react. And then when I saw how widespread it was, realized, well, this really does prove that the impact Star Trek had, or even in a more basic sense, you know, Big Bang Theory is the number one show. The geeks did win the revolution. They're all running all the major, you know, tech companies. I mean, did any of that filter through, be on top of obviously what was a family, you know, event?
Well, yeah, we knew that Spock was popular, and we knew that Dad had some fans, but we were not prepared for what we saw happening in the social media, in the print media. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the New York Times reported that they got more hits on Dad's obituary than any other personality in the history of the paper.
I can believe
Wow.
Yeah, which was, it's a pleasant surprise. I mean, we were not prepared for it though. And then people who were contacting us, the family members, me in particular, you know, personally, through email and phone messages and snail mail. I mean, there were people coming out from my childhood who I had not talked to in years who were contacting me. So it was like a tidal wave. There was so much in the print media as well. It was really overwhelming. But I also have to say it was kind of like reassuring in a way, and it was comforting to be going through the loss of the patriarch of our family and having to readjust without him, and at the same time being buoyed by all this goodwill and all this love, you know, for Dad. It was a great comfort to me anyway. But it was not what we expected, that is for sure. And it was also the thing that after a month of time of permeating with all this, that I came to understand that this film that I'm making is something that really would be of interest to so many fans of my dad and Mr. Spock, to kind of get a perspective on who Spock is, some of the anecdotes about Spock, and the life and legacy of Leonard Nimoy, which was, you know, and he had a very long and successful career.
Right. So you did notice it at the time. I mean, as you said, you'd already been talking about doing the documentary well before he passed. So this, if nothing else, this just redoubled the need and desire and the audience.
Well, I guess this transformed it too, right? From something about his career into something that's also remembering his legacy as well.
Yeah. What's interesting was we were going to initially focus on Spock with a little bit about Leonard Nimoy. My dad had a very, you know, humble side to him, and he did not want to make it a Leonard Nimoy documentary. But when he passed away, it was clear that we had to expand on who he was as an artist and where he came from, his humble roots in the West End of Boston, and how far his career had, the trajectory of his career, which is just absolutely amazing. And as we continued to move along with the project, and more people became attached to help me with the project and support me, and we brought on producers and publicists and to try to get this thing off the ground, it became more and more clear that it was also would be of interest for me to tell my own personal story of my relationship with my dad, my relationship with Star Trek, my experience with Star Trek, because that element of it is unique, would bring something to the film that nobody else could make.
Oh, absolutely. And I wanted to ask you about that, because I think for a lot of fans, not even aware of your own career and the fact that you trained as a lawyer and then got into the industry and had a lot of credits, and that Star Trek kind of helped kick that off. But for a lot of fans, I think, especially the ones who have been around the longest or the savvier, they had that image of you showing up in the blooper reel with the Vulcan ears on. Do you remember that day? I mean, because the other case that I have a close understanding of is Rod Roddenberry's relationship with his dad, being a late child growing up. Star Trek for him was that thing his dad did that was so overpowering in the family that he kind of ran away from it, and it wasn't until his dad's last year or two, and then when he was, you know, then he didn't have him, that he started realizing, oh my God, this is, you know, trying to find the father-son connection there, and did his own documentary, which started off as a son searching for his father. And I get the feeling that you're obviously much more enmeshed with your dad. I mean, can you go back? Do you remember, to a simple level, do you remember the day, the ears and Freddie Phillips putting them on and filming and all that? Because there are photographs as well as the blooper moment.
Right, yeah. Well, Larry, I remember it. I was going to say vaguely, but no, that's not true at all. I mean, I remember it vividly. I was almost 10 years old, and I was very excited about being on the set. I was very aware of my dad's career leading up to that point. I'd been watching him on TV, and I knew some of the episodes that he had been on leading up to Star Trek. When Star Trek came along and we could see some Polaroids of what his makeup was going to look like on that original pilot, I was very excited about that because, you know, he was different. He was an alien. He was half human, half alien. And, you know, boys at that age are love that stuff. We're quite impressionable by that stuff. I mean, by that time I'm watching TV pretty consistently and collecting comic books. So, you know, I'm the demographic a part of the demographic they were looking for. It was a great day to be on the set. The whole backstory behind that of them putting the ears on me was that Dad often was known for staying in character throughout the day while they were shooting. Mm-hmm. In fact, he was in character a lot when he came home. He talked about this a lot in his autobiography, that he had trouble going in and out of character from being jovial, you know, happy-go-lucky Leonard Nimoy to more, you know, sedate, serene Mr. Spock. So he stayed in character most of the day. And one of the objectives of Bill Shatner and the cast and crew was to find ways to get Dad to laugh. And Bill used to steal Dad's bicycle. You know, when they called lunch, mm-hmm. Dad would hop on his bike and go down to the commissary and be first in line. And Bill kind of led this band of guys who would steal his bike and hang it in on places so that Dad couldn't find it. That's their idea of a joke. Because Bill was very, you know, Bill liked to joke around. And the work is so hard, having a lot of experience directing TV, that we're always looking for a reason to laugh. But Dad was very, always in his Spock bag, they used to call it, which was a kind of a 60s terminology. That was his bag. So mm-hmm. one of the ways that they thought they would get him to crack a smile was to stick me into, take me into the makeup trailer, which was on the set. And I sat down in Fred Phillips's chair. He cut my hair, he shaved my eyebrows, and he stuck those ears on me, oversized, of course. My ears were not quite as big as my dad's. And then they walked me around the back of the stage into the turbo lift. The scene was from an episode entitled What Little Girls Are Made Of. And Kirk is down on the planet, and Spock is sitting in the captain's chair. And while he's communicating with the captain, I come out of the turbo lift and walk down and give him a kiss and say, "Hello, Daddy." The crew and the cast are cracking up. Dad managed to crack a smile because he's looking at them like, you know, he knew it was that put me up to it, basically. But it was fun. You know, it's very memorable. I can still see myself in the turbo lift waiting for my cue when they open the door to step out. You know, I love being on the set. I loved everything about Star Trek. I loved watching them make it. I watched a number of episodes. I was there several times during the first season. I maintain that I am the first Trekkie, because that, you know, gag that we pulled on Dad was actually in the beginning of the shooting of that particular episode, which was July of 1966, a good month and a half before the show aired. So, I knew what was going on, and I was in on the ride from the very beginning, and I was really privileged to be so.
That's great. Thank you for all that history, because now we know exactly where and What Are Little Girls Made Of is one of the early episodes. So that's the placing in the timeline, the chronologies is really pretty fascinating. So you were not only with Spock and Star Trek, but you were beyond the age where this was your dad's job, but it was also cool. I mean, all that as a kid figuring out when their parents are actors and knowing, you know, my dad goes off and gets paid to be make-believing and dressing up, that you'd already matured into the point where you got it. And obviously, you were 10. So,
well, I was a fan of Leonard Nimoy before we got to Star Trek, because I used to watch The Outer Limits, which he was on, and Sea Hunt I watched, which he was on, and Combat I watched, which he was on, and Man from U.N.C.L.E., which, you know, I watched all these shows. Mm-hmm. And there he would appear. Sometimes he would appear and surprise me because I didn't know he was going to be in the episode. And the last major role he did before Star Trek started with the series was a Gunsmoke episode in which he plays an Indian, Johnny Walking Fox, I think was his character's name. And Dad took me with him to the Western Costume Company, which was a major institution in Hollywood, because when they came to Hollywood, they started making Westerns. And this company formed so that they would have authentic wardrobe to dress, the cowboys and Native Americans. So Dad took me there. He left me waiting. This is a warehouse on Melrose Avenue where right next to where Paramount mm-hmm. Pictures is. And he left me for about a half an hour, and he popped out completely dressed head to toe in buckskin with a wig. And that was most exciting. One of the most exciting days of my life. He was living Indian. I mean, he looked the part. He had the face for it. He had the cheekbones for it. Mm-hmm. He had the stature for it. It was awesome. It was such an incredible experience for me. And my dad played characters, and I really got the sense of that then. And the interesting thing is that I think is what really keyed Gene Roddenberry into Dad. He had the look that he was interested in for the part of Spock, which is why he started to pursue Dad for that role. When that came up in 1964, they shot the first pilot.
Yeah. Aside from memories of your dad, and it's great to hear that you were on the set so often. So you had a lot of, hey, go to work with Dad kind of days. I guess. I mean, did you go to school and come over to the stage after, or go over the lot afterwards? Or did you get to skip school? Or was it in the summer and you were out of school? Or you said that was July?
Wait, that summer before school started in September, they were shooting through June, July, and August.
Right.
And I spent a lot, and I did it every summer. I would try to spend as many days as I could on the set. I would go to work with my dad very early in the morning. And I would get picked up by my mother sometime in the, you know, in the early afternoon or right after lunch. So I was there a lot, and it was really, really exciting to be hanging around.
Yeah. Well, while we're in this mindset, do you have any memories of any of the other cast or any of the other even crew that people might be familiar with? But I'm thinking of some of the, like D. Kelly or Jimmy Doohan had sons.
Well, I had probably the closest relations with D. Kelly and a little bit with Nichelle and George and Bill. I mean, not even that much. It's only been recently since I've been working on this movie that I have been more interactive with those guys, particularly Bill Shatner, because he's helping me with this fundraising campaign we have going on Kickstarter to try to raise the fixed funding amount we need to actually make this documentary on Dad and Spock. So Bill has been, I interviewed him this week along with George and Walter Koenig. Bill has been tweeting for me. He has been talking about this mm-hmm. in the press, this project, and he's trying to get the word out to the Trek community that we need people to get on that website to pledge to get us to the funding amount we need to get the film done.
Yeah, good ally to have there on that kind of.
Oh, he's amazing. His social media presence is fantastic.
Yeah,
reconnecting with Bill has been fantastic. He had a lot of love and respect for my dad. They had a lot of ups and downs in their relationship as close friends, mm-hmm. which is not unusual for anybody, but he has really stepped up to the plate. He signed autographs for photos for me for rewards giveaway on this Kickstarter thing.
That's great.
Yeah. He's been absolutely unbelievable and probably my biggest supporter in getting this project done.
Yeah. And I know I said George has a huge following too, and I saw him tweeting in support.
Exactly. And George has a major presence, social media presence now. Very active man at this point in his life. He's got a play coming out on Broadway called mm-hmm. Allegiance about the history of Japanese Americans during World War II. And he has also, you know, stepped up to the plate for me to help me generate interest in our campaign on Kickstarter to find the funding for the film.
Yeah. How was it with, as the series ended, your dad went on to his theater career, getting into his photography, and you were getting older and getting on with your own life. How was the father-son dynamic through, you know, the 70s and the 80s? And then Star Trek's comeback. And do you remember any of his thoughts about the comeback years? Because there was, you know, famously the motion picture when, you know, being involved, not being involved. Does Spock need to go away? Oh, no, maybe it's worth doing some more. I mean, do you have any insights on those years or what he shared with you?
Yeah, well, the 70s were kind of an interesting period. Dad was trying to challenge himself in other roles. He did a lot of theater work. We did Summer Stock in 1971 with Fiddler on the Roof. He was in Man in the Glass Booth, very challenging work. He was in Equus, which mm-hmm. was a phenomenal, phenomenal production. He was absolutely excellent. It was like one of the, those three roles, when I watched him in live theater, where he was trying to challenge himself as an actor, were moments where I really lost sight of the fact that he was my father. He had so inhabited those roles. He was really, you know, he was an excellent actor, and he was at the top of his game at that point, and he wanted to keep moving on. When Star Trek came around, and we had the syndicated, you know, series going 5 days a week. I was at school at Berkeley, and I'm going to tell you, every day at 5 o'clock, that dorm, the entire dorm building emptied out, and people were crammed into the TV room watching the show, which was a very interesting experience for me because I had not been aware of how popular it had become. And on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, we had a store called the Federation Trading Post, which was exclusively dedicated to Star Trek paraphernalia, which blew my mind. My roommate, you know, dragged me there to take a look at it. And there were pictures of me on the bridge with Dad with my ears on. So it was exciting.
You were an iconic part of Star Trek fandom.
Well,
in America.
I'm a small part of the Trek lore, let's put it that way.
And did your friends at the time in school, did they rib you about that, seeing you in pictures like that?
Well, yeah, when the show was on the air, I got a lot of feedback about that. I had an interesting experience with, I was in junior high school, and one of the class bullies who used to beat me up when he found out I was Leonard Spock's son, he stopped beating me up and he protected me against any other bullies who came at me.
Really?
Yeah, it was really weird, yeah.
He's heard of the Vulcan pinch, and he thought it might run in the family.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think it was more like he was just a fan. That too, though. But you know, but the funny thing with him was that every time he saw me in the halls between classes, he would call me Ears. He'd yell out Ears in front of everybody. He thought that was so funny. So yeah, a lot of the kids at school. I try to keep a low profile actually at school, and just kind of like lose the last name thing, and because it was just not. I didn't need to draw that kind of attention to myself.
Right.
But then, you know, when the 70s wore on and they started getting into the movies, there was some issues between Dad and Paramount about merchandising and royalties. And same thing with Bill Shatner came up that they had to resolve. And then Dad wrote, "I Am Not Spock," created a big fan furor. There was a big lashback on that. So he was willing to come back, you know, and get involved with the Trek franchise. And then he tried to challenge himself again by getting behind the camera during the making of those films, which I thought he did a really good job with.
He did.
So it was a great, you know, Star Trek's been a very interesting ride, and it's been something that I've always enjoyed watching the whole, you know, just the whole development of the show into the franchise of the feature films, and now the reboot with JJ.
Right. Well, and then where I kind of caught up with it on your end was when I was working on my Next Generation book and kind of catching up a little bit on your biography. But so the early movies start off where, right, he decides to stay in, then he leverages it out to his directing. And then he goes on to, you know, Three Men and a Baby, and was it The Good Wife?
Right. The Good Mother.
And Good Mother, yeah. But you went to law school. Were you trying to, what was your, I can see two scenarios there, just knowing entertainment and families there. One of it is either like running away from Dad's career, which I don't get the vibe of, or it was more like, whatever I do, I want the security of, hey, I at least have my law degree, however life takes me. Because then you wound up coming back and working with Nick Meyer on Six and then directing and having, you know, a good career doing that. What was going on with you back in those, as a guy finding yourself?
Well, I think you kind of alluded to exactly what was going on is that, you know, I was very aware of what was happening with my father and his career before Star Trek came along. And it was a struggle. It was a real, real struggle. Dad had a lot of odd jobs that he had to keep going, doing to get the money to keep us afloat while he pursued his passion, which was acting. So that, for that reason, I wanted to find something that was more secure. I was more academically oriented than Dad, even though my father was a Renaissance man with a lot of interests and a very fine mind. He had very, very little formal education, but it was just not his thing. But I was very inclined academically, and I always wanted to go to law school. I had always thought about going to law school, and I wanted to travel my own path, you know, and do something that he did not or could not do. And after 7 years of practicing law, it became perfectly clear to me I was not born for that profession. And my life changed one day when I went to an acting class with a guy named Jeff Corey, who happened to be my father's acting instructor. And my dad took over Jeff's acting class and was teaching that class to make extra money in the early 60s because Jeff had been blacklisted, so he had to teach. But then he went back to work. But I was in that class with Jeff, and it totally changed my mind because I was so impressed by the work they were doing. I was so excited by the work they were doing. I was so burnt out by the work I was doing in the law, and it was so difficult to find a really good jobs in the law. That then and there, I really decided to make that career change because I had some creative impulses. You know, I'm like my dad. I'm my dad's son. You can't I can't get away from that. And Dad was very instrumental in helping me make that transition by teaching me about directing, by focusing me on classes I needed to take, by getting me that job with Nick Meyer, who I am greatly indebted to, walking around with Nick on that set and learning from the cast and crew about how a film is made, and then by The Next Generation taking me on for two episodes.
Right, right. So we should point out, too, that Jeff Corey, that you spoke of, that was such a great teacher, who had, been blacklisted. Trek fans will remember him as playing High Commissioner Plasis on The Cloudminders, just for who also had a Trek connection there. So you by the time you decided to try the waters and take advantage, as many people have when they've got that proximity, to jump in and try to take advantage of the Trek. Rick Berman used to call it Trek School, or the directing school of Star Trek, or whatever.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that relationship? And I have quotes from Rick, and I have quotes from you and the conversation I had with you on the phone back when I wrote The Companion, but about coming in and direct. Because the two episodes you did for Next Generation were Rascals and Timescape, which are two completely different. Was it just luck of the draw, or what was the process? Did you say, hey, I'd love to direct, and okay, let's vet you a little more, and then these are the luck of the draw shows, or what was that process like?
Well, the process was, first and foremost, you need to know, Larry, I think I may have mentioned this when you interviewed me way back when, was that I spent an entire season with The Next Generation just observing, watching directors. And there were a couple of key directors who I glommed onto because I thought they were really good and really knew what they were doing. That was an unpaid position. You know, I had to find, part-time work, and my wife was working and doing very well, which allowed me, the luxury of going to school, Trek school, by just being there and observing those guys. So I was very lucky that Rick, welcomed me into that community. And I was lucky that there were directors who came through there who were very talented, who also took me under their wing. So, but then when I actually and I had been taking a number of classes, acting classes, directing classes, editing classes prior to that, but you don't know what it's like until you're in it.
Right.
It was very difficult, for me, because it's very difficult work. It's very strenuous work. It's long hours. You need to be very prepared. Dad helped me break down the scripts. You need to know a lot about the camera, how the crew works, and how to deal with actors, how to work with actors, how to collaborate with actors. And a lot of that I did not know. So they were really difficult, challenging learning experiences for me. I didn't knock it out of the park right out of the box, I'll tell you that right now. But those shows did get me some basic training on what directing was all about. Then I made a short film on my own, which really helped mature me as a director. And then I embarked on a career, with the help of Dad. We remade the Outer Limits episode that he was in that I loved so much as a kid, iRobot. And that really helped me, bring me further along in my education. And then I was lucky enough to get an episode of NYPD Blue, and then I was off and running. But, you got to start somewhere. And I was glad that I had, Next Generation family to help me along, because they were very supportive. Very helpful and gave me a lot of direction on the ups and downs of my newfound career.
Right. Well, and totally in your defense. I mean, those are Timescape especially, I think, has a good memory. And a lot of people love Rascals just because it was so off the wall. But in your defense, as a practical work experience, you had a bunch of kids, to deal with on your first time out on, your maiden voyage like that. I just remember I was going back through some quotes from Rick and saying, after Rascals, it's like, well, we owe you one with grown-ups. And then Timescape turns into the huge, opticals and visual effects episode. So you had a totally different taste of directing there, episodic TV and science fiction. And Tall Orders, they weren't just little milquetoast. Of course, it was Star Trek, which isn't going to be that very often anyway for anybody.
Right.
But that was a great experience both ways, I would think. Yeah.
Well, Adam, I have a question with directing. Now, this is after you've been directing for a pretty good while, but you did episodes of Ally McBeal and The Practice, which are both law shows, but one's comedic and one's serious. But having gone to law school and then you're behind the camera, how did that play into how you approached shooting those shows?
I I thought that it might be helpful to, you know, to have that law background. Is yeah. It was basically of absolutely no value whatsoever.
Well, I can see that on Ally McBeal.
Not even on Ally McBeal? Right.
No value whatsoever. I was not a litigating attorney, which those shows are based on. I was a transactional contracts lawyer and okay. had no bearing, you know, whatsoever. Those shows were completely different challenges. And, you know, it's all about, it's really, here's the thing. And I learned a lot of this from my dad. First time directors, directors who are just learning their craft are obsessed with where to put the camera. Obsessed. Mm-hmm. Where's the camera go? Where's the camera go? And this is something I teach in my classes when I was teaching at the film school. What dad taught me is the camera goes where the camera goes. The issue that you have to really focus on in these shows is what is the scene about? What's happening in the scene? And that's based on the theme of your overall story. What are the objectives of the characters in the scene? What do they want from each other? What are their needs from each other? When you figure that out, you start to figure out where they are in the scene physically, where they're moving in that scene, where, you know, are they close together? Are they far apart? What, you know, that's all determined on based on what the scene is about and what their needs are. Once you figure out how the actors, where they are placed in this scene, we call it blocking, then you, it becomes perfectly very clear as to where that camera goes. So these shows, yeah, I have to approach in that with that respect. They have, you know, those shows have been around. When you go to a show like The Practice of Ally McBeal, and they've been on for a couple of seasons, mm-hmm. and they know how to shoot that show, your focus has to be on working with the talent, working with the actors, figuring out interesting ways to play scenes, and relying on the camera crew to help you capture it on film.
And Star Trek is the same way, right? If you're walking into TNG or DS9 or Voyager.
Yeah, it's complicated. When they've been around for a while, it's a whole different ballgame for guys like me. I'm not a producing director. I was a journeyman director. I'm there for 8 days of prep, 8 days of shooting, and I'm gone to another show. So, and if they've been around for a while and they're successful, they don't really need or rely on me whatsoever, from my opinion. They just want to see whether or not I can deliver an adequate episode for the series. Right. When you're in first season on a show, you know, in the first order of that season, that's a different matter. Then they're really trying to support you and help you, and you have some more input on what the look of the show is and how the characters are being developed.
Right. But we mentioned that all three of those series, but that's the nature of TV directing in general versus a feature, where the TV, the least dialed in person is the director. I mean, the crew is familiar, and the director's coming in to fulfill a slot in the season, but in as opposed to a feature where the director is king, basically. It's his vision, supposedly, depending on who's producing, you know, what slot the writer and the producer have. But
right, that all depends on circumstance. But for the most part, TV, you know, TV directing, it is a writer-producer medium, right. That's for sure. However, if I have been on shows where early enough on where I had a lot of input about how that show should look and how those characters should be developed. The same is true in features. I mean, you can get on features with very strong producers and be a first-time director, and I guarantee you that producer is going to be running you roughshod and in control of what's happening there. So it just depends on the circumstances. I've had, you know, all the whole range of experience, but it is very challenging to come into a show like The Next Generation on season 5 or 6, whenever I came on. They've been a running, you know, running freight train, and you got to run and get on that train and better be prepared or you're going to get hit and hurt.
Right. Right. Well, it's almost got, I mean, we say that, but with these franchise movies, the tentpole blockbuster movies, it's almost getting to that point with the directors at times, within, and I guess we'll see what Justin Lin does with Star Trek III. I guess it's not quite that ironclad, but because it seems like they're taking a pause and reanalyzing here and reanimating. What have the Next Generation movies and then now the JJ reboot? What's been your opinion of the cinema history on the Trek side? Yeah, because you had been involved with 6 and then directed Next Gen, and then your dad kind of cycled around here with the JJs, especially. Had you paid, you know, and you'd had experience with Rick Berman and that administration and watching their movies maybe come out. What's your impressions of the Trek cinema heritage since then?
I just think that the franchise needed new blood and a new point of view and a fresh light. And I think JJ is doing a great job. And I think the prequel idea has been excellent. I love Chris Pine. I love Zoe Saldana. I love Zachary Quinto. Zachary Quinto is going to be narrating this documentary about my dad and Spock. I think, you know, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what this next installment is going to look like. So I find it very entertaining. I think it's heartwarming that dad was able to continue on and you know, be drafted into that whole reboot. You know, he worked very well with Zachary, and the two of them had a very strong relationship, you know, personal relationship outside of the making of that movie. And I think they really, it's a very exciting, you know, whole new chapter and whole new energized life for the franchise, which I think is wonderful. It keeps Spock alive.
Yeah. Even the commercial they did together is a hoot.
Adam, what kind of conversations have you had with Zachary, and, you know, being Leonard's son and then seeing him, at least for me as an observer, it seems like your father had a very strong influence on Zachary Quinto as well as a mentor. Have you guys had any conversation about that? What have you noticed there?
You know, I've had a few conversations with Zachary since my dad's passing, getting to know him better myself and getting closer to him. He's sort of been adopted by our family. He's still very close with my stepmother, Susan. And he did have a very strong, apparently he lost his father at a very early age. So he kind of glommed onto my dad as a father figure. I think it was a really wonderful and beautiful relationship. I really respected their relationship. And it's because of that, that in a weird way, Zachary and I have kind of bonded as sort of stepbrothers and are looking at have the same point of view about trying to pay tribute to and create something that'll be a definitive look at the life of Leonard Nimoy and the role he created, which is why when I asked Zachary if he would narrate, without hesitation, he said yes. So I'm very excited about looking forward to working with him. We've cut a little sizzle reel together, which he narrated for me. And I think he's going to play a prominent role in helping me get this film off the ground. Now he has been signed to for this next installment, and he's very busy. He's going to be on location with that shoot. So he's going to be difficult to get a hold of. But we have a few months to get this project together, and I know I'll be back rendezvousing with him soon to figure out what our next step is. But I think he's a terrific actor and just an outstanding human being.
Right. In his role as narrator, are you far enough along to know if that's going to be an unseen narrator, and then he's also on camera doing his own share of reflecting? Or do you know yet if he's serving both sides, their narrator and as one of the participants, or...
I don't know. I know we need him for narration. I know I want him for narration.
Right.
I mean, I wasn't planning on being on camera. Now I need to talk a little bit about my dad from my personal point of view with him and some of the trials and tribulations of growing up with Spock in the house. We're not clear as to whether or not we're going to have Zachary on camera. He just may be, I don't know. It's really something that we have to think about.
No, it's early in the process. I'm working on a document myself about a famous event that your dad was on the periphery of, and I had actually approached him here just the last few months, but I think it was when he was turning a lot of things aside. But it did make me think. I wanted to ask you, aside from Star Trek and the professional career, he's been wonderfully open here as the COPD, you know, became more of a presence in his life, and trying to maintain his public persona as well as his photography and his other pursuits that he was so, you know, he enjoyed so much and wanted to share. Can you talk a little bit what the last few years have been like? And he's been, again, very public. And when he closed down his active appearances at conventions and other places, and then came up with even this. I was at the first convention where he did the Skype appearance, which was just blew my mind, because I thought, here is Leonard Nimoy and Spock pioneering something else, you know, another thing here where he's found a way to still come to people and share. But then even that went away as the disease progressed. Can you talk about, you know, as much as you feel in a comfort zone with here the last few years?
Yeah, well, that's been kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, there's been a lot of highs and a lot of lows. I mean, the last few years of his life, he As he used to say, he majored in family and minored in career, which was not the case during most of our lives with him, where he was just not around and not as involved with the family. And, I had a lot of periods of estrangement from him, in fact, because we just were not connecting or communicating. We were very lucky that he got to the third act of his life, which was his devotion to family. We got to spend a lot of time with him. He was very involved in my life and reconnecting our relationship and our love for one another and my sister. And he was very connected to the grandkids, and my kids and my sister's kids all have individual relationships with him, very different because all those kids are different. But he spent a lot of time focused on socializing with them, family dinners at the house with my stepmother, Susan, and just being together as a group. By the same token, his health was deteriorating. We used to spend quite a lot of time in Lake Tahoe together, which he was no longer able to do because the air was too thin there for him. He couldn't breathe. And a lot of his activities were slowed down. He had a number of offers to go overseas for Star Trek conventions, and he was not able to honor those requests because, and as much as he did, he loved the fans and he loved to make appearances for the fans and pay tribute to the fans who were what really this whole ride has been all about. And he felt very bad about not being able to do that anymore. And when there was possible talk about him being in this last installment of the Star Trek reboot, he also was concerned about his health and had to pass, thinking that he may not be able to, to function as a performer on set. Mm-hmm. So, it was a very interesting time. I'm really glad we had the time together. I think my dad was very lucky. He was a heavy smoker for a number of years, but, making it to 83 is a feat. He lived a great life, and we all really kind of enjoyed reveling in his warmth and love of the family man of Leonard Nimoy, and that's what he ended up being. He really understood what really mattered in the end, and that's why I have so much love and respect for him and so grateful that we had these years together.
Yeah. Now, your son, Jonah, is he the one that plays guitar?
Right.
Okay, because I think that's who was with him that first time I saw him at a convention on Skype. And
He accompanies my dad on Maiden Wine, a song my dad performed for the series, and he wrote for the series.
So the documentary was a natural, but and it's expanded here in scope the last few months. So where are you with it? Your crowdfunding, and it's a documentary, so it's that's a bit of a journey from where you start. You've got a pretty consistent subject. It's not like we're investigating what happened to the dinosaurs or anything, but what is there an influx? Do you have it pretty much scoped out? Is that part of it?
Well, we've been working on this since November of last year when I came up with the idea with my dad. A lot of research, looking at the episodes. Looking for still photographs, looking for articles, looking for home movies, talking to people, colleagues of my dad. We had a couple of production days this week out of pocket because we need to get started on this film, and the crowdfunding on Kickstarter will not end until a week from Wednesday, the 1st of July. So we have moved ahead and spent a lot of time and energy starting to put this project together. We interviewed, as I said, the core crew of the Enterprise and people who work with my dad, and we're starting editorial now. I have a script. We have a strong outline. We have much of the narration that we want for, all this is done. We're ready to go. Really. We have a couple more production days we need to do for interviews with people like J.J. Abrams. Seth MacFarlane has agreed to be interviewed. That's going to be down the road, but most of it is in the editing room and acquiring, licensing all this material that I need to pay for from the powers that be that own Star Trek. I mean, they're working with us on it in terms of what our budget is, but we still have to pay for and acquire this material. So right now, what's ahead of us is the editorial, is putting the pieces together. And then we'll have a composer come in and we'll go to do sound editing and everything that we need to do to make a polished, professional, first-rate feature presentation of the lives of Leonard Nimoy and Mr. Spock.
Right. Well, and beyond Spock.
And beyond Spock. It will still be Spock-centric because really the intent is still to celebrate 50 years of Mr. Spock. And he is still Dad's most famous role. And he still is the character that seems to resonate across the board with people all over the world. That was the initial intent of the documentary, and that I'm gonna honor that. Right. We have so much material in Spock, and he's such an incredible character to investigate. But again, what the percentages will be of Leonard Nimoy's life and my perspective on Leonard Nimoy and Mr. Spock, I don't know. It'll be predominantly Spock, right. And the rest we'll see how much we put in.
Well, having started in at least planning pre-production in November, did he go on camera for anything of this before his health took the really low turn, or did that ever happen, or did you not want to go there?
I wanted to get him on camera because he told me, you know, he was concerned about how long he had, and that was in November, December. And then a week later, I said, you know, I'm putting a camera crew together. We want to come over and interview you. And he said to me, well, what's the hurry? We have till 2016. And I said, well, you said that you're worried about how long you're going to be around. He said, I was having a bad day. I'm fine. Today I'm fine. You know, but we were ready to go and to shoot him, but we didn't do it. And we don't have it for this particular project. What we do have, however, is a lot of interviews of him, which right. I have to get cleared and acquire. A lot of material of him on camera talking about Star Trek. We have a lot of material of him at conventions talking about his Star Trek experiences. I have a lot of great film with him in Boston when we made our documentary together about his early life growing up and what it was like coming back to Boston during the Star Trek years. So we have enough of Dad, and we have his two books. Right. So we have enough of him to get us. And I took a lot of notes with him when we were sitting down and just talking about mm-hmm. the project. So there's plenty of material for this film to get his perspective on what his career was about, what Mr. Spock was about, what the legacy of Spock becoming an icon is all about.
Right. It's obviously out there. Well, one of the other projects that was in motion that kind of got in a heightened focus was, and I don't know how familiar you are, and we had her, or Chris had her on the show, and I came along to kind of help out, but a woman named Bonnie Moss that's in the South had helped put together this photo retrospective of his work that's at there's an art center in North Carolina there in the University Triad area that had been in motion that he was involved with and his gallerist and that kind of took on added meaning after he passed. Anyway, some of the other facets that people aren't as familiar with.
Well, it was similar in that it wasn't meant to be a retrospective, but during the planning, then mm-hmm. Leonard passed away and it also took on that extra component.
Right. So anyway, I hope you are including the photography and the parts that people aren't as familiar with. The other thing that's striking to me is in the 80s when Star Trek IV, the Whales movie, came out, and it was 86, and it was kind of the first time the studio marked an anniversary of Star Trek, kind of accepted it as, oh, this is a valuable asset, much less, this is something we can celebrate, much less it's a valuable commercial asset. And they announced, you know, the Next Generation comeback. And that was the year that Newsweek did a front page story on the enduring value of Star Trek. And suddenly, instead of being this little nerdy thing that those kids do on the weekends, it was mainstream. And, you know, the image they chose to represent on the cover of Newsweek for the first time was not a cast picture. It wasn't the Enterprise. It was your dad in his Spock character on the, you know. And I just always thought that was very iconic in a lot of ways. Talking about that reaction after he passed, that's the way a lot of the world, everything that, in many ways, a lot of things that Star Trek stood for and Gene's vision and all that people talk about was personified by your dad's character. So it's just, that helps explain why it was so elevated to so many people that way.
Yeah, there's been it's so interesting, Larry. There's so many different facets of how Star Trek and Spock have permeated the pop culture community and the entertainment industry, because there are references to him all the time.
And NASA and the space community and the science community and all, you know,
exactly,
all of that.
Exactly. Yeah. And the internet explosion has plenty mm-hmm. of Star Trek material documented on there. So all these things have sort of conspired to keep the whole legacy and the reboot and the movies and the syndicated and the spin-off series. All these things have continued to add to the legacy of Star Trek, which has kept it alive over 50 years.
Right. So what's the status of the Kickstarter, the campaign, and the documentary is set for next year. That's your timetable, right?
We want to have it delivered before at the beginning of 2016 to start to take advantage of the film festival circuit, mm-hmm. To start the celebration early of the anniversary of the series.
And I noticed, Adam, as we're recording this, you've picked up a little bit over $2,000.
Ooh,
just as
exciting.
We've been recording here.
Yeah, we're asking the fixed funding amount of $600,000. We think that's what we need to get this film made in a first-class production or a very solid production. And we are right now, we just passed over $400,000. We have 10 days left. We believe we're going to make our goal. It's been a lot of work to generate interest and get fans to become aware of what we are doing. We have gone to, you know, media and podcasts and print media and television and social media to get the word out of what we're doing, because we need to energize the community to come together and to participate by pledging, whether it's $5 or $10,000. And we have some momentum now, thankfully, and it looks like we're on a trajectory mm-hmm. to make our goal, but we're not taking mm-hmm. anything for granted. And I've been, you know, doing a lot of press over the past week to try to get the word out, because I feel very passionate about the film, and we have so many passionate Star Trek fans like you guys, and you know, we want you involved in the process. This is a way to involve the Trek community. So we are looking forward to a successful campaign, and I'm looking forward to the point where I can refocus my energy instead of on the campaign to making the film, because that's
right.
what I
right.
my
yeah.
you know, that's where my interest was from the beginning. And there's a lot of work ahead of us to make it look like something really special, which I know it will be. We have so many good interviews with the cast and with colleagues of my dad. I mean, the interview with Bill Shatner was it was just heartbreaking and beautiful and wonderful, and you know, it should be seen, but the only way it's going to be seen is in this film, and the only way this film is going to be seen is if we have the financing to make it happen.
And what kind of, apart from of course helping make this documentary happen, what kind of other perks and benefits can people get when they donate? Because people do love to receive mementos and key items, you know, related to Spock and Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, we have a number of rewards depending on what level you contribute at. We do have some physical items, mostly we have photographs of key crew members, cast members, and some very rare items in that respect. Most of the stuff that we have to focus on for the giveaways are going to be premieres, private screenings, visiting with me and the editing bay. A lot of things that we have to put on there are not necessarily physical, because it costs money to manufacture and produce. We're trying to get more of that stuff, but it's better for us to have digital downloads. We're going to have a digital stream of the movie within a certain window so that the fans who have participated can see it at the same time that we are premiering it at these film festivals and in theaters. A lot of what we are offering is digital downloads for people to have immediate access to. There's some items that we have that are physical items we're going to send out. But again, we have to limit that because it's incredibly expensive to service a lot of people
right.
with postage and shipping and manufacture. That just eats away at the production budget. And as it is, we have to pay commissions to Kickstarter and to whatever funding service we use to charge people, PayPal whatever service we go through. So that's 5-7% right away that we have to give back. And so we are trying to limit the giveaways, you know, to special yeah. things. We have some very special items that we're putting on, and more are coming up as we move along. But the goal is for people just to come together to the product they're going to get is a really good film, which
yeah,
I think
exactly.
the community will appreciate, because it's something that will last. And it'll be different and new, you know, a lot of us in that community are looking for new things. And I think this will really satisfy that need.
You know, that percentage may not sound like a lot to people. I don't know, 5 or 7%. It sounds like a tax basically. But when you're talking about 600,000, I mean, you guys are going to be netting, what, about 530 of 600 by the time you pay all those fees, right?
That is
so it's
correct.
It's a pretty
this
big
is a stand, yeah, startup. Yeah.
yeah.
Right.
Plus fulfilling perks, as you're saying, you know, physical items, that eats away a lot of the budget as well.
Yeah, we're going to have special screenings that I will be attending. You know, these things we can manage, which are much more manageable for us financially. But the point is to try to preserve as much as the production budget as possible, because quite honestly, we need the money. Again, the producers, the people I've been working with, we've had a lot of, you know, we've been running on empty on our own fumes, on our own finances to keep things going. These production days we've had and sitting in the editing room and starting to put things together, all on our own time, unpaid. And that's why we need the Trek community to, you know, to kind of step up and it can be a small contribution. We're not asking for major money. It's really, you know, if just a fraction of the millions of people who are Trek fans could give a small amount, you know, then we would be in good shape. But we're still trying to get the word out.
It all adds up. I mean, if you look at what LeVar did with Reading Rainbow last year, I guess that was last year, right? That massive amount. If you look through those donations, that was mostly $5, $10, $20, $25 per person that led to that massive success for them. So it doesn't have to be a huge amount.
It does not. But it does not.
Well, I know completely from experience, I know completely where you're at. And also both on the production level and also then trying to get something crowdfunded. And with we were all helping there at the beginning with the promotion, but having the heavyweights and the heavy hitters come on board, check in from the crew and getting this momentum going, well, hopefully that will sail you on through. And what we're all trying to do to get, because there's no better place for this to come through. When I heard you were doing, first heard you were doing the documentary, it's like, well, how much closer to the source can you can you come up with? So can we get to? So we're all hoping to spread the word and
thank you.
Get you over the finish line.
Definitely.
Thank you. I appreciate that so much. We need all the support we can get. I've been running ragged trying to get the word out to people to get what we need to get through here. And we've only got 10 days left in this campaign. And if we don't make that fixed funding amount, we don't get a penny.
Right. As Kickstarter goes.
So Adam, tell everyone where to go if they want to donate.
Go to Kickstarter.com and look up for The Love of Spock. It's that simple. Just go to the Kickstarter webpage and either we're going to be on that, the opening page, you can scroll down and find us, or there's a search box for us, for The Love of Spock. You'll find us. Our social media handles are hashtag SpockDoc. You'll find us. We have a Facebook page for The Love of Spock. You'll find us. We're all over them. We're everywhere. Just like Spock, wherever you turn, that's the great thing about Spock. You know, you can just, wherever you are, wherever you turn, there's Spock. He's there. And somewhere, somehow, some way, his image just keeps, you know, coming up over and over again, which I'm really proud of. I'm really proud of my dad for what he has accomplished with his life. He's been a great inspiration to me and to people all over the world. He is a great guy who really understood what priorities were in his life, and I'm just so appreciative that he was around for the third act of his life, which was family man for me and him to reconnect and find a lot of the love that we had lost over the years. And I just, you know, I have an absolute need and desire to make a definitive statement about what he is all about. As an artist and what Spock is all about in terms of being a symbol, an archetype that people can relate to from all different social stratas, from all over the world, that being the outsider can be cool. Being a loner, if you're not in a social group, can still be cool. Trying to work through your emotional side of yourself is something that all people go through. A lot of adolescents identify with Spock because of that. You know, there's just he has permeated throughout many levels of society, and I think he is due a tribute of this caliber, which is why I'm, you know, giving everything I have to make it become possible.
Right. Well, I would say thanks for sharing so much of the private feeling there, and all those locations you mentioned online are great for sharing. But the bottom line is, share so that everyone does kick in and helps put this together.
Right. Thank you, Larry. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for your time today. And we're going to do our best to help you get over that goal there of 600,000, because we definitely want to see this documentary made. And I mean, I know for me personally, and I think pretty much any Star Trek fan will say this, I mean, your dad really meant so much to me growing up and had such an influence on me. So hopefully we can help.
Thank you, Chris. I greatly appreciate you guys taking the time. I appreciate you inviting me to speak with you. It's always nice to talk to fans who know a lot about the history of Star Trek, and it was really an honor to be on your program.
Absolutely, Adam. Thanks.
Well, Larry, that was really interesting to talk about Adam and to find out, you know, the firsthand what it was like growing up with Leonard Nimoy, and of course, hearing about the documentary.
I just love the fact that he remembered the day he shot that blooper footage that some of us have been watching since the 70s. I just that was a real highlight.
Yeah, it really was. I'm not surprised. I mean, he was 10, so those right. things kind of stick around right. with you.
Well,
from
here's
that
the
point on.
Yeah,
if he had been 5,
and here's
maybe
to
not.
Them, you know, crossing that finish line and sailing right through and having a wonderful piece of memory work for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Leonard Nimoy isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network recently, so here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
So I just stopped, watched it, and just cried like a child. It was such an emotional impact. I was wrecked.
Earl Grey.
You know, what the clubs and the meetings and the podcasts, you know, all really comes down to is just finding and talking and being around other people who enjoy something that you really enjoy.
The Orb.
This year, opening for 5-year mission is Del Rock.
Del Rock.
Del Rock. They'll rock your world. Bajoran style.
The Ready Room.
I do like that he just drops out of the sky naked. That is the perfect way to introduce Q. And then just before we cut to the credits, they get this great shot of him looking up at Picard, and he's like, hey, what up?
To the journey!
My question is, what would Janeway have in place of banana pancakes? Because that's B'Elanna's thing. Would Janeway's be coffee ice cream?
I was just about to say coffee ice cream. My lips were forming the syllables to say coffee ice cream. Warp 5.
I remember watching Broken Bow when Enterprise first debuted when I was in high school. I remember revisiting it now in full, and I had forgotten the fact that Future Guy had actually played an integral role from the get-go with Silic and the Sulaban, which we'll talk about later in the show.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
I know that both of us will come out of it okay, but since Matthew is not used to sparring with either of us, I'm afraid that he's going to be a bloody mess lying on the floor of the 602 Club.
The 602 Club.
They're playing God with fossilized mosquitoes as if, you know, they have the right to do this, like they have the knowledge to do this, you know, that they can control any kind of species that they have absolutely no knowledge of.
Literary Treks.
Yeah, this happened to her at 22 when she was on Ryan's Hope, and it was at its peak. There, it had a big following, and it was not your typical run-of-the-mill soap opera either. I mean, Claire Levine, the writer of the show, was doing some very different things.
Axanar, the official podcast.
I tried different action figures. I tried Black Widow. I tried the Black Widow from the Hot Toys Black Widow. Too small. It wouldn't work with
really?
The other action. Yeah, it didn't photograph quite.
But tell everyone why you're photographing action figures.
And introducing the newest addition to the network, Women at Warp.
Also, you think Kirk would be happier about kissing himself.
Right?
It was his lifelong ambition.
Yeah. I don't know. I more feel like it's his lifelong ambition to kiss Spock, but maybe that's just me.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. Of course, we're in iTunes. Check out our artist section at itunes.com/trekfm. You can also find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Spreaker, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. You can go to the website and stream from the show page. Grab the RSS link or download the MP3 file. And just check out all the shows. We have such great talk, and we really appreciate everyone who supports the shows by leaving us ratings and reviews in iTunes. Those make a big difference in how we rank in the search results in iTunes. So please take a moment while you're there and leave us a star rating and a written review. And we'd also like to thank our patrons who support us through Patreon. They make it possible for us to keep the show coming to you, not only the Ready Room each week, but all of our shows every day of every week. You can support us as well by going to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. You can choose any amount that you would like to donate on a month-to-month basis. We also have great perks for you there. And we finally have kicked off our patron roundtables. For those who support us at $25 per month or higher, we now have situations just like our shows here, where you can get together with the hosts. We record a Star Trek discussion and we put that out through our master feed. So I'd love for you to take part in that as well. Norm and Will just recorded the first one with Ken Tripp and Jeffrey Harlan as well. And that's going to be coming out to you any moment now in the master feed. And I'd also like to thank Renee Roberts, our associate producer here on The Ready Room. She's been a huge supporter of the network ever since I started it 5 years ago. I love Renee and I thank her so much for her support. And you can find her on Twitter at @Mares_1701. Send Renee a note. Tell her thank you so much for supporting the network and The Ready Room. All right, so Larry, I mentioned at the top of the show that you're about to hit the road. I know you've got all kinds of stuff coming up. So for everyone who loves to follow Larry Nemechek around, what's going on? Where can they find you? What's happening?
Well, live, yeah, we're hitting the heart of convention season. So this week I'm going to be back home at SoonerCon in Oklahoma City at the end of June. And then I've got some gigs going on at a Thursday night panel at San Diego Comic-Con. Our annual behind the or between the cracks show. We'll be talking about Leonard and other.
We're
topics.
Not taking you behind the scenes. We're taking you between the cracks.
Between the cracks, right? All the stuff that falls between, right? Behind the cracks, even. But no, that's the show. When I finally got it through my head that you had to name everything instead of it can't just be Larry's show.
Tune in to Larry's show.
It's the Larry show. The Larry. So even Comic-Con, which is like 150, 200,000 people, it's nice to be in the program grid somewhere. So Thursday night, if you're in San Diego with all the other millions of humanity squished in there, but a couple of table times, and we're doing a Dr. Trek show at the San Diego condo there right next door of Kat Roberts, who's one of our big backers on Continues and is supporting the documentary too. So anyway, appearance there in San Diego. And then, of course, Vegas Trek is right around the corner too. And I don't know if I've been able to tell Trek FM yet, but I'm going to be at Salt Lake City's Comic-Con at the end of September and looking forward to doing that. And then all of those, you know, Enterprise and Space, which is by then we may have some really big news to share with everyone, but that's continuing apace at enterpriseinspace.org, which is the nonprofit to orbit 100 over 100 student projects in space in 5 years and be a testbed demonstrator for a new generation computer and other aspects that's crowdfunded around the world and reaching out to school kids of all ages and persuasions. And thank you, I think, for your support too. So yeah, the Con of Wrath, our documentary that I mentioned with Adam. We're shooting some more on that next week in Oklahoma City and in Dallas, in and around CinerCon. And my Trek... thanks to you, I should say again, we're working on our Volume 4 in our Trekland on Speaker CD.
Yeah, I was going to say, so, rumor has it that in the midst of all this stuff, you and I are working on a new CD, which maybe...
I'm working on it. So I just want to say, if you've been patiently awaiting, if you're a fan of Voyager and been patiently awaiting for us to get around to Voyager, we're going to be marking the 20th anniversary of
the premiere
of Voyager with The Caretaker.
Yeah.
In fact, I came up with the title today. I'm going to call it Taking Care of Caretaker will be the actual title of the CD. So anyway, that'll be debuted at Vegas and then on my website where everything is. At LarryNemechek.com. And of course, Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook and at Larry Nemechek on Twitter. If you don't mind putting up with Sooner football and some politics and Will Rogers and other cool stuff.
Well, I put up with it.
I think that's about it.
And
yeah.
Of course, I'm an Alabama fan. So.
And if you can, everybody can. And of course, if you're a collector, I'm still putting things up every week from my archives at the Trekland Trunk. On Facebook. It's just a list to get on. You can see what's up there. And we do the live. Most every Sunday, we do a little 3-hour live event with some of our regulars. And it's kind of a rowdy bunch. but we always welcome newcomers. That's just go to the Facebook and the Twitter for the Trekland trunk and see what's up and for the live ones, or see what's on eBay. There's 3 or 4 or 5 things a week up there too. So yeah, that's full. And on top of all of that, my voiceover career is continuing apace, and I have an out-of-the-box new Star Trek program that I'm feverishly working on to announce next month and to really bring out in force at Vegas Trek this year. I've been talking about it for a year and a half, and with everything else going on, it's hard to juggle it in. Of course, I still support and stay in the think tank as a creative consultant with Star Trek Continues. And we had a little mini drama of it being dropped off of YouTube, which, yeah, as it turned out, was not due to CBS. That's another mini story.
Yeah.
But it is, as of now, it is back up on, it was never gone from our site or from Vimeo, but it's back up on YouTube.
We should just say quickly so people won't be wondering. It's exactly what most of us figured it probably was, which is YouTube has these automated bots that go around and scan, right, and they just take things down, and that's what happened.
But CBS just made it clear that it was not taken down because of them.
Yeah.
And which was correcting the automated, you know, the automated message that's even up there. So
this happens.
Kudos
to
all that.
Yeah.
It's over it. If you haven't seen it yet, help us make up for the ticker being gone for 2 months or 2 weeks and back that. So, yeah, so lots of things going on. I can't talk about my new cool thing that's just me and Star Trek coming up, but for another month or so. But I hope everybody's watching out for that too, on top of the pile of everything else I'm saying grace over. So.
All right. Well, I think the question on everyone's mind listening right now, Larry, is when are you going to get off your butt and do something?
Jeez. Get off my butt, Chris. Leave me alone. I'm just, you know, hanging out here as a surfer dude in LA, and I'm just, Yeah. Well, I'm going to go home and see Home Peeps next week. So I'll get back to work after that. I promise.
Awesome.
And then we'll get on with Volume 4.
We will. Yes. All right. Well, if you'd like to find me, I don't have quite as much going on as Larry does, but you can find me on Twitter. My username is C Brian Jones there. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook. You can find me in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook, which is a great place to come and talk with other listeners and all of our hosts. It's a closed group, so you do need to go there and click join, but just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. And you can find Larry there as well. He comes in and comments on things from time to time as well.
I especially comment when I forgot to mention Geek Nation Tours and our 2016 San Francisco edition to the LA tour.
This is
back
true.
To your normally scheduled Chris closing.
Yes, this is true. All right. And so anyway, you can find me there and you can find Larry there. And then on the network, besides the show, you can find me doing The Orb with Matthew Rushing, where we talk about Deep Space Nine. I do Hyperchannel from time to time. And then I'm behind the scenes on the AxonR podcast, although you'll be able to catch me on the most recent episode of that as soon as it drops, where Norm Lau and I got together with Alec and Rob Burnett to talk about AxonR and how fandom is, you know, becoming a movement. So that was a fun discussion we had there as well. So you can find me in all those places. And then, of course, on my own personal website at cbrianjones.com. Now, if you'd like to send feedback on this show, you can find the network on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. Of course, you can go to the Babel Conference, which I just mentioned. You can send a voicemail by going to speakpipe.com/TrekFM, the word speak and the word pipe.com/TrekFM, or go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form there, choose to send to a show, and choose the ready room, and that'll come to me by email. And I'd love to hear from you about the show today. And what you thought about what Adam talked about and the documentary, as well as Star Trek Uncharted, Nichelle Nichols, all the things that we talked about today. So hope you'll give us some feedback there. All right, Larry. Well, I think that's all we have to talk about today. So I'm going to head back and continue my work on writing the 12th track about Spock's brain for 5-Year Mission.
I know. I'm exhausted. And really, Chris, when you look at it, it's time to stick a Boston Lurba in it because, you know, the ready room is done.